Good day, everyone, and welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Conference Call. Today's call is being recorded. Now, for introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Joseph Lam. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Wen, and welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is WebSphere MQ Queue Manager Clustering. Today's presenter is Beverly Brown and Anshu Wissera. Beverly Brown has been in WebSphere MQL2 support since 1997 after 10 years in TIC support. She primarily supports MQ on the ZOS and VSC platforms, but has also supported MQ on distributed platforms. And Anshu Wissera is in WebSphere MQ distributed level 2 customer support, supporting WebSphere MQ on Unix and Windows platforms. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Beverly and Anshu.
Hello, this is Beverly Brown, and thanks for joining us for this presentation on WebSphere MQ Queue Manager Clustering. If we look at slide 2, please. We may have a broad audience today. Many of you may have used clustering already, but I will make the assumption that it's possible that a few of you haven't yet used it. So we'll start at the beginning and just give a quick description of what clustering is. Go through the steps of setting up a basic cluster. If you haven't done it before, you need to do this first and understand it before you go on to a more complicated setup. We'll go through some display commands that you can use to look at the status of the cluster and the cluster objects. We'll take a look at workload balancing, which can allow you to distribute messages to multiple instances of a cluster queue. I'll give you some references to some intermediate and advanced configuration and administration topics. We won't have time to go into those in depth, but I would like to let you know what some of those topics are and where the information is so that you can do some reading on it on your own. And we'll go through some troubleshooting, hints and tips, and information. And then we'll also have some references to some other manuals and tech notes and information. If you're not familiar with the term tech notes, that's a document that is created by the support center or development that may have a problem symptom and solution, or it may have hints and tips, or it may tell you what sort of documentation to get for a problem. And you can access those from the MQ support webpage. So if we move on to slide 3, basically what is clustering? It's just a way that you can logically group some of your queue managers. And it gives a couple of advantages. One is it involves reduced system administration. You have far fewer manual definitions for channels and for queue remotes and transmission queues. So it just cuts down on your definitions. Also, another advantage is that it can give you increased availability and workload balancing because you can have multiple instances of the same queue. You would have an instance of the same queue on multiple queue managers in the cluster, and you can distribute messages to those queues. Now, shared queuing also can give you this increased availability and workload balancing, but shared queuing would only work where you have a sysplex, whereas clustering can reach around the world. And if we move on to slide 4, please. So now we're on slide 4. And what we'll be doing here is going through some of the steps from Chapter 3 of the Queue Manager Clusters Manual. And this is just how to set up a basic cluster. So to begin with, step 1 is you would decide on the organization of the cluster and its name. The organization might involve isolating a particular application or some other consideration, geography or something like that. So you'll decide on that organization and the name. If we go to slide 5, step 2 is you need to determine which queue manager or queue managers will hold full repositories. A full repository contains information about all of the cluster objects, all of the cluster channels and queues. That is in contrast to a partial repository that would only know about the cluster objects, the channels and queues that it needs to know about, that it has actually tried to reference. Usually you would have at least 2 full repositories. You need at least 1, but preferably 2. If you need more than 2, though, you need to be sure that the connectivity is set up properly. And I would refer you to Chapter 7 of the Clusters Manual for a couple of figures that shows some configurations to ensure that you have good connectivity. A queue manager sends out information about itself to only 2 full repositories, so you just need to be sure that it can get to the full repositories it needs to. And where your repositories are may depend, again, on geography, availability, reliability of the queue managers, and factors such as that. On slide 6, now that you've decided which queue managers will be full repositories, on those key managers, you will alter the key manager object and tell it the cluster name in the repos option. So this is only for the full repositories that you do this step. On to slide 7. Step 4. The first object you'll define will be your cluster receiver channels, and you want to do these first. These have a little bit more power than you're accustomed to with regular receiver channels. And what you'll have is each queue manager in the cluster will have a cluster receiver with a con name pointing to itself. If you look at the example defined channel definition, you'll see that it has the cluster name in it. And then in the con name, this is different from what you're used to. It will actually be the IP name or address and port of my queue manager. So you're advertising to other people how to get to you. So we'll do that first. And then, onto slide 6, you'll define the cluster sender channel. And this is where it will be different. You won't define a cluster sender to everybody, but each key manager in the cluster will have a cluster sender to a full repository key manager. And the name would match that of the cluster receiver on the full repository. I want to caution you not to define a manual cluster sender to a partial repository. At best, you'll have some unnecessary and redundant definitions, and it's somewhat defeating the purpose of clustering. At worst, a queue manager might send information to that partial repository expecting it to take action like a full repository, and that action won't happen, so you could actually cause some problems in the repository itself. So just minimize your manual cluster sender definitions. And in this case, your con name is the traditional remote IP name or address and port. And notice you tell the cluster name there. On slide 9, next you'll define your cluster queues. And you can have the same cluster queue name on several different queue managers. Now, other queue managers in the cluster can send messages to them without making queue remote definitions for it. It asks the repository, do you know this name? And the repository tells it where instances of that cluster live. And you'll notice that you just add the cluster option on your typical defined queue local command. And just, again, to put this in a different way, queue manager A can put a message, and it could go to a queue on queue manager B, queue manager C, and so forth. However, only the local queue manager can read messages from an instance of a cluster queue. So queue manager A can't get a message that lives on a queue that's on queue manager B. And then slide 10. Now that you've got your basic setup done, you'll verify and test the cluster. We'll see some slides coming up that have some display commands where you can review the definitions and the status. And you can use one of your own programs or one of the sample programs to test putting messages to the cluster queues and to make sure it works. Now, there is more detail of all of this, again, if you go into Chapter 3 of the Queue Manager Clusters Manual, but it's the basic idea of what you'll be doing. If we look at slide 10, here I've included a figure from the Queue Manager Clusters Manual, figure 8, and this will give you a more of a picture of what's going on. We'll stay on the slide for a moment, but slide 12 will contain the points that I'm making. What we have here are three queue managers. Two of those, QM1 and QM2, are full repositories. And you can see that by the icon, the little disk icon in the upper right-hand corner of those queue managers. QM2 and QM3 have some queues defined on them, and those will be cluster queues in this case. Now, the solid lines represent the manual cluster channels. The arrows going out would be the manual cluster senders, and the arrows going in would be the manual cluster receivers. You'll see that the two full repositories have channels pointing to each other. They can find each other. And then Queue Manager 3 has a manual cluster sender pointing to the full repository QM2. Now, if we notice over on QM1, we're not showing any application queues. What we're showing is a system.cluster.transmit queue. And this is the transmit queue that the cluster channels use to move the messages to the appropriate queue manager. So queue manager 1 can say, I want to put to this cluster queue name. Now notice we have some dashed lines, and what those represent are automatically defined cluster channels, that the full repository was able to tell QM1 where QM3 lives. So it now has, without any manual definitions to QM3, it actually has a channel to QM3. And QM2 also has an automatically defined cluster channel to QM3. So now QM1 can put messages to both QM2 and QM3. And if we go on to slide 12, again, most of what I said is there. The other point I wanted to make is about the system cluster queues. In addition to the transmit queue, there is the system cluster command queue. Normally, the transmit and the command queue will be empty unless you have something building up on them. But if everything's working well, those will be empty. And you also have the system.cluster.repository.queue. Now, it will always have messages on it if you're using clusters. That's where the repository manager saves its information that it knows about the cluster. On distributed platforms, these queues are automatically defined. But for ZOS, there are sample definitions that you will need to include in your input data set. And the member that you will find these in is CSQ4INSX. Again, that's CSQ, the number 4, I as in Indian, N as in Nancy, S as in sugar, X as in X-ray. If we go on to slide 13, please. We'll start talking about some of these display commands that you can use. Some of the parameters in the display queue manager command that are important to clustering are repos, repos.nl, and QMID. We'll talk about repos.nl shortly, but it's where you can put a name list instead of just a single cluster name. Now, if a queue manager is a full repository, it will have something in repos or repos.nl. If it's a partial repository, those two parameters will be blank. I also want to point out this QMID, the queue manager ID. That is an ID that is unique, and it's generated when the queue manager is created. It will consist of the queue manager name and then a date and timestamp. You can see on the screen there that for distributed platforms, the date is actually a normal readable date and time. For ZOS, it's actually the 16-digit system time. It's not as easy to read, but you can at least use it to correlate. You can tell if something is the same or different, so you can correlate QMIs in that way. And the importance of that you'll see later on. On slide 14, one of the big display commands that you'll use is display plus queue manager. Now, on the next screen, I have the output for just one cluster queue manager, but it was only one of several that my command actually output. And we won't go through every single parameter on here, but there were a few fields that I wanted to point out to you. So over on the left-hand side, the fields that I have in bold, you'll see that this represents a cluster queue manager called QM2. And this information is about a channel, 2.QM2, and that's a typical naming convention. Give it the name 2, dot, and then the queue manager name. You can see the cluster name there, QM plus. You can see the con name. If you look over to the right side, just under con name, there is something called def type, and that's the definition type. Now, this one is plus sender B, and how I associate that is I think of the B as meaning both, meaning it was both manually defined and automatically defined. When you do the manual definition, that allows a queue manager to connect to the full repository, but then the full repository also builds an automatic definition using information from the cluster receiver. So really, your cluster receiver is going to trump your manual cluster sender on information, but your cluster sender is still going to tell you how to get to that full repository. So this is plus sender B. You might have something there that says plus sender A, and that is one that is only automatically defined. Or it might be a cluster receiver that we see here. If we move on to slide 15, these are some more fields that you'll see. And over on the left-hand side, here again, you'll see the QMID that's associated with this cluster queue manager. To the right of that, you see the QM type. Now, this one says repos. What that means is that this cluster queue manager, QM2, is a full repository. The other option would be a QM type of normal. Normal would mean that this is information about a partial repository. And then back over to the left-hand side, the status shows running. One other thing I wanted to point out about the QMID is that it will be reset if you delete and redefine a QManager or cold start it, or if you restore from an old backup. And if you end up with different QMIDs for the same cluster QManager, you can run into a little bit of trouble. So troubleshooting, we'll talk about that. On slide 16, I've already discussed the first part of that about the def type. And again, I think I already pointed this out, auto-defined cluster sender channels take their attributes from the cluster receiver channel definition. Now, you can't automatically modify an auto-defined cluster sender. You actually modify the cluster receiver on the other end, and then that information is flowed back and updated in the automatic. The other thing about auto-defined channels is that you won't see them via display channel. The display channel only shows the definitions that you've manually made. On slide 17, I already discussed the QM type of LePaz and normal. Now, for cluster receivers, you're not going to actually see their status on this display cluster QManager information. You'll need to use display channel status for that. If you think about it, a QManager only has one cluster receiver definition in this simple setup, but it can have multiple QManagers connecting into it and using that same cluster receiver name. So then on slide 18, we'll look at this display channel status. And some of this information will be your normal channel status information you're accustomed to looking at. We have the channel name and the status here of running the transmit queue. And notice that it's system.cluster.transmit queue. To the right-hand side, you'll have the channel type. The first one is a cluster sender, and it's pointing to remote queue name QM2. Now, I'd like to point out here the cluster receivers. We have the second and the fourth channel statuses have to do with cluster receiver. Now, notice that they're both called 2.qm1. So I did this display on 2.qm1. So this is talking about its cluster receivers, but you'll notice that the RQM name, the remote queue manager name, is different for those two. One of them is QM2 and one of them is QM3. And you can see there that in this case they're running. It would be okay for them to be running or inactive. They'll have some trouble if they're stopped or retrying, and information won't be able to flow. It's very important that channels back and forth be able to run. All right, on to slide 19, please. Another display command that's unique to clustering is display QCluster. And this will show the queues that are in the cluster. So you can see the queue name. In this case, we have two instances of queues called inquiry. And the plus queue manager shows which queue manager that actually lives on. One was on QM2, one was on QM1. You have the QMID there again. Over on the right-hand side, you'll have the cluster name and the queue type, whether it's queue local, queue alias, that sort of thing. And then def bind. And that's something that's going to have something to do with workload balancing. We'll talk about that a little bit later. I'll just point out that the default for this def bind is bind on open. And depending on what you want to do, you may need to change it to not fixed. But again, we'll talk about that more. Slide 20. I just wanted to point out again, the queue cluster will only display information about cluster queues, but I want to point out that on a partial repository, it will only show queues where an application has actually opened it. Say if you are looking at this on QManager 1 and you've defined a queue on QManager 2, QManager 1 isn't going to know about it here. You'll actually have to have an application open it at the repository where it is, and then you'll be able to see it on this display. On slide 21, this is a little bit of a twist on the normal display queue command. And you can add the clus info parameter, and you'll see here that it will show you those type queue clusters that we were just looking at in addition to your other non-clustered queues. And on to slide 22, please. Another reminder, the information is obtained only from this queue manager's repository, so the partial won't know about it. And this is a time for me to mention all of these display commands I've been showing you the output from were from the command line. You can also see cluster information using the MQ Explorer. And especially the version 6 MQ Explorer has better cluster information. If your ZOS queue manager is version 6, which now has PCS support, you can use the MQ Explorer to do remote administration and actually look at the ZOS, actually administer the ZOS cluster from there. So But either way, you'd still be able to see information about your cluster. I'd like to advertise that Angel and I had a presentation on remote administration last fall, and the webcast playback number for that, or the tech note for that webcast playback, is 700-8431. Again, that's 700-8431. And you can go out to the IBM website and search on that number and get to that information. Let's go on to slide 23 now, please. The concept of workload balancing. So say you define multiple instances of a cluster queue on different queue managers. Workload balancing will determine which of those queue managers is the best one to route the message to. And it will take into consideration such things as whether the queue is enabled or disabled, whether the channel is running or not, whether the queue manager is suspended from the cluster or not. There's a hierarchy of things that are considered. And what this is called is the workload balance algorithm. Now, this algorithm is described in the cluster manual. In the 531 book, the algorithm is described in Chapter 11. In the 6.0 book, it's in Chapter 5. It got moved to a little bit more of a logical place in the version 6 book, in the workload balancing section. Now, in version 6, another thing that was added is something called cluster workload use queue. As a default, if you have a local queue defined and you're trying to open that queue, it's going to just use that local queue and not go out into the cluster. However, if you set cluster workload use queue to any, that tells the repository to treat that local queue as just another instance of the cluster queue, and it will put it into that workload balance algorithm. Now, at its very simplest, workload management can result in a round-robin effect. Say you have three queue managers with a cluster queue, and from another queue manager you put 9 messages. Simplest scenario, 3 would go to each one of the instances of the cluster queue. Now, it starts getting a little bit more complicated as your environment gets more complicated. Another factor in the algorithm that I meant to mention is which channel is least recently used. So if a channel was used to send a message for another queue, or even a repository internal message to a queue manager, that's no longer the least recently used. So depending on how things are flowing, it may not end up being exactly round robin, but you will still get a workload balance. You can't really predict exactly which instance of a queue will be chosen for a given message, but just know that it will be distributed. Slide 24, please. Now here I have listed some additional parameters that were added in version 6 that can influence the results of the algorithm. I won't go into detail, but you can look them up in the Queue Manager Clusters manual or in the MQSC command reference and see if any of those might be useful in your environment. Or you can also just write your own cluster workload user exit if you have special needs of how to distribute the work. On slide 25, all right, for this workload balancing to have the round-robin effect, it depends on how the queue was opened. If the queue is open with a default of bind on open, that says, all right, I'm going to open this queue. The repository manager will decide which instance of the queue is the one that you will open, but from then on out, for the life of that open handle, that same instance of the queue will be used. However, if you choose to use bind not fixed, each message will go through the workload balance algorithm to decide which instance of the queue to use. So it just depends on if your application has what we call message affinity. Say if one message goes to a queue manager and you need all the other messages associated with it to go to the same queue manager, you need to use bind on open. But if each message stands alone and can go anywhere, you can use bind not fixed. There are a couple of ways to specify that. One is with your open options, you can explicitly say, I want bind not fixed. Or if you use the default of open option of bind as queue defined, then you can use that def bind option that we saw earlier to say not fixed or open. And on to slide 26, please. Another thing that you can do is in the message descriptor. Normally, with clustering, you'd leave the object queue manager name blank, and that would allow the queue manager to choose which queue instance the message will go to. if you're using the bind not fixed. Now, if you want to force a message to a specific instance of the cluster queue, you can specify that queue manager's name and object queue manager name that parameter. And one other thing I wanted to point out about the difference in the bind option. Say you put a message to the transmit queue, to the cluster transmit queue, and it's defined as bind on open, but the channel to the queue manager that was chosen is down. That message is going to sit on that transmit queue until the channel is available to send the message to that particular instance of the queue manager. If you've used bind not fixed, the repository manager can say, "Ah, the first place I chose isn't available, so I can reroute it to another queue." So that would give you some more flexibility in distributing your workload. Now on to slide 27, a couple of things about some intermediate configuration. I mentioned earlier a name list, and what that allows you to do is put a list of cluster names in a name list. You can have multiple name lists. Those name lists can have totally different sets of queue managers, or they can have subsets. They can have overlapping lists of names. And you can have a particular queue manager be a full repository for some of the clusters it's in, or all. You have your choice on that. Again, it just depends on how you build your name list. And with name lists, you use the repos NL or clus NL parameters in your object definitions as opposed to repos and cluster. Slide 28, please. Getting more complicated, Chapter 4 has some information on how you can use queue manager aliases, queue aliases, or reply to queue aliases, and it will allow a much more complex environment. For example, you can put from a queue manager that's outside a cluster to a queue that lives in the cluster. And that might happen if you have two companies communicating with each other. Or you can put to the queue manager that lives outside the cluster. Now, this is something you just need to go to the book and read it again, give it a try. It has some sample definitions. Just do it and play with it, and then it'll start making sense to you. And you'll be able to see the power of how you can use that advanced configuration. On slide 29, another section of the manual that is your friend is Chapter 9. And this has some of the advanced tasks that tell you how to add or remove objects or key managers from the cluster. Now, especially if you are removing a key manager from a cluster or entirely removing a cluster, please read these tasks. If you just start trying to do things intuitively, it might not work as you expect, and things might not get cleaned up properly, and you'll end up with some problems in the cluster. So use these steps to do your administration. Now, I will say that the version 6 manual added an additional step for removing a key manager from a cluster, and that's doing a refresh. It will apply to version 5 as well, we found recently, but that's just actually made it into the documentation there. And then another APAR, IY, that is I as in Indian, Y as in yellow, 85851. Again, that's IY85851. Clarifies that update a little bit further. All right, and now I would like to hand over to Angel, and he'll pick up with the troubleshooting section. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Angel Rivera, and in this section of the webcast, I would like to mention some hints on troubleshooting, and this is in page 30. Even though it is not included in the PDF file, as Beverly mentioned, the NQ Explorer version 6 allows you to visualize, manage, and perform troubleshooting tasks related to NQ clusters. For example, the Explorer has a set of folders that shows the different clusters, and for each cluster, it shows the full repositories, the partial repositories. And for each repository, it shows a graphic of the connected queue managers, and there are tables that show the cluster queues, the cluster sender channels, and the cluster receiver channels and their statuses. Now let's continue with the material in page 30 on troubleshooting. Let's begin with some very basic questions in case you have problems with clusters. If at least one of the full repository managers is still running, you will have to check the AMQ error log or the Nginx job log. And you need to check, as Beverly mentioned, that the channels need to be run in both directions. What you can do is display the cluster queue manager and the display channel status information. You have to ask also, are the system cluster queues enabled? And what you can do is issue the display queue and system.c asterisk and show all the attributes. In that way, you will see all the system.cluster queues. Also, you will need to see if there are messages in the system cluster command queue or in the system cluster transmit queue. As Beverly mentioned, if there are messages, for example, in the system cluster transmit queue, this could be an indication that the channel towards the message needs to be flowing if it's not active. Also, one thing that you need to check is if there are duplicate QMIDs for a given queue manager. When you issue the display cluster queue manager and show the QMID, and if there is one queue manager that has two entries, then it means that probably there was an additional definition, and this could cause some problems. Let's go to page 31, please. In these troubleshooting scenarios, you can see that the command display cluster manager shows names starting with system.temp. In this case, this means that the queue manager has not received all the necessary information from the full repository. Another scenario is when the cluster cache on ZOS fills, and for this case, see the tech note 1240731 for a problem caused by distributed queue managers in the cluster. In NQ version 6, you can set CL cache dynamic to dynamically increase the cache storage. For ZOS, is module CSQXRRMF at a current level. Let's go to page 32, please. Troubleshooting with refresh and reset. The commands refresh cluster and reset cluster do not need to be issued under normal circumstances. They will not fix a cluster that has a bad configuration or that lacks connectivity. These commands can make matters worse in such situations. For more details, see the NQ commands reference manual. Let's go to page 33, please. Troubleshooting refresh. The command refresh cluster removes and rebuilds locally held information about a cluster. The second line says refresh cluster repos no. This is the default behavior, and the queue manager retains knowledge of all cluster queue managers and cluster queues marked as locally defined, and all cluster queue managers that are marked as full repositories. If the queue manager is a full repository, it retains knowledge of the other cluster queue managers. Everything else is removed from the local copy of the repository and rebuilt from the other full repositories. The next line is refresh cluster repos yes. Specifies that in addition to the repos no behavior, it refreshes information about full repository queue managers and may not be issued from a full repository. The last entry says refresh cluster with an asterisk. In this case, the queue manager is refreshed in all the clusters to which it belongs. Page 34, troubleshooting reset. The reset cluster command is issued from a full repository queue manager. It forcibly removes a queue manager or a specific QMID from a cluster. The default behavior is queues no, which means that the cluster queues owned by the queue manager being forced to be moved are not removed from the cluster. In this case, we have two commands. The first command is just using the queue manager name, and the second command is using the QMID. Let's go to page 35, please. This page shows some references for supported website and manuals. The first line is the WebSphere MQ product support page. You can search for fixes and non-defect solutions. The next entry is the NQ library, from where you can download the NQ manual, including the WebSphere NQ Queue Manager and Clusters manual. In the Appendix 6 of this manual, there is a troubleshooting which lists common error symptoms and causes, plus some problem scenarios with our solutions. Page 36, please. There is a very good tech note, which is the most gathered documentation required by WebSphere MQ clustering problems. The number is 1178839. It includes information such as how to avoid cluster problems, includes clustering terminology, mentions the documentation that is required and diagnostic tips, and it is the best reference material for MQ problem determination on this topic. Let's go to page 37, please. In this tech note, For permanent determination, it provides instructions on how to run two commands. The first command is a utility called AMQRFDM and can be run in Unix and in Windows. And it collects a lot of information, including subscription, cluster queues, cluster queue managers, browse, transmission queue, and miscellaneous data. This information is interpreted by the AMQ support team. Let's go to page 38, please. Also, in this most gathered document, tells how to use run MQSC with a command that has some responses, some files, some commands, sorry. It's called cluscmd.txt for cluster commands. And it's very useful to collect at once the display called cluster queue manager, the queue manager names, the channel details for cluster sender, cluster receiver, the channel status, the name list, and the queues. Let's go to page 39. The additional technos. The first one is mentioned here is 1229905, which is the MQ clustering, cluster hints and tips. This technode refers to other useful technodes, including the following, which is not mentioned in this PDF file. 1225022, which talks about the NQ return code 2189 cluster resolution error from NQ open, which means that a queue manager has not been able to determine if a given queue is shared within clusters of which it is a member. Another technode, which is the second entry in this page, it is the support pack MD05 MQ series design considerations for large clusters, and the number is 4006367. It addresses some of the challenges encountered in the design of MQ cluster solutions for large-scale installations, and it is based on work done with a major UK customer. The last entry in the page is 4006424. It is the support pack MP7A, WebSphere NQ for Windows 5.3 performance tuning for large clusters. It describes the results of performance tests made on a large cluster containing up to 5,000 simulated queue managers. Page 40, please. Some additional references are in Developer Works, one article, Enabling SSL in an Existing MQ Cluster. The second article is Migrating MQ Queue Manager Clusters to WebSphere Version 6. And the last entry is the Red Book, WebSphere MQ V6 Fundamentals. It includes a section with the step-by-step instructions on how to create a cluster for hands-on experimentation. This is a very good material for beginners. Page 41. Please use the WebSphere MQ Queue Manager Clusters Manual as guidance for configuration, administration, and troubleshooting. And also, search the support database for fixes and solutions. Page 42. We have additional WebSphere product resources, and this chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth technical information. The events link on support pages points you to webcasts and conference information. Visit WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get the new users up the learning curve quickly. The ESR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Support link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you. Now, page 43, questions and answers.
Thank you, Bethany, and I'm here for a great presentation. At this point, Wen, we would like to open the line for questions.
We'll go first to Johanna Geisler with Citigroup.
Hello. My question is, when you have duplicate QMIDs, does the cluster prefer the one with the more recent date and timestamp?
This is Beverly. Yes, typically you would go with the more recent one. The only time I've seen you want to go with the older one is if somebody has restored from an old backup. But most of the time it's a case of deleting and redefining the queue manager, in which case you do want the newer timestamp.
Where is that QMID stored? Is it on page set zero, or is it within the cluster repository itself?
Well, some of both. It is an attribute of the queue manager, which would be in page set zero, but it would also be in some of the cluster information about the various objects.
So the QMID is known throughout the cluster, not just within page set zero of the queue manager you're currently looking at.
Right. And, for instance, distributed wouldn't have a page set. It would be safe wherever the key manager attributes are saved. But then that information is copied into the repository information.
Okay. I'm looking at a situation where I'm going to run the same key manager from different IP addresses, and I'm wondering if the different IP address will cause me to have a different QMID for that same key manager.
If it's really the same key manager using the same page set, it will be the same QMID. If it's a different instance of the key manager, say on a backup site, then it would be a different QMID.
So if I copy across the page sets, I'll retain my QMID when I go to my new IP address?
Right.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Robert Kukinich with X-Wave.
Hello there. I had a question about, I was doing some daylight savings times testing, and so I had moved my OS, I'm on Windows, my system time ahead in time to November. And when I got there, on my repository key managers, all of my cluster key managers that were non-repositories were gone. And I was just wondering if you have any idea if you could explain that. I know it's kind of a non-realistic test because we jumped so far ahead in time.
Right. That would have to do with the retention information of information in the cluster. And there is information in the Key Manager Cluster book where it talks about that retention. Basically, every 27 days, a Key Manager is going to advertise itself about what information it has and is using. And if after 30 days, say an object has been deleted and it's been 30 days, then that, say, queue will be marked for delete. However, after an additional 60 days, meaning a total of 90 days, then it will be deleted. So based on that time stamp, it thought, well, it's been more than 90 days, so I'm going to clean up this information.
Okay, great. Thanks.
You're welcome.
We'll go next to Ken Litvin with J.P. Morgan.
Hi. We were trying to remove a key manager from a cluster, and we had followed the procedures in the version 6 documentation. And when we got to the step where on the key manager that we were removing, we altered the cluster receiver to blank out the cluster name. And according to the instructions, it said that now from a full repository key manager, you should be able to do a display plus key manager on that key manager that was being removed, and you should get object not found. And, you know, we did not get that. Instead, we got a display, you know, like a full display of information. And, you know, one of the things I was wondering was whether maybe that's because we had a cluster sender defined pointing to that key manager that was being removed, which was a full repository key manager. And maybe until we get rid of the cluster sender, we would still see information when we do the display cluster key manager?
Certainly, as long as the channel is running, you could still see a status.
Oh, we made it go inactive, actually. So
okay.
Even after that, we still got a display. It did not come back with anything like object not found.
Okay. My most recent thing that I was doing was removing a partial as opposed to a full. And there can be a bit of a delay as you're doing some of this information depending on how long it takes to broadcast the information out to all of the clusters and whether the channels do need some time to stop and for things to clean up. So it may not be instantaneous, but it sounds like in that case it took a while. So you're saying you were removing a full from the cluster.
Right, and from the other full repository that
still
had a cluster sender pointing to the one that we were removing, we did a display plus key manager name of the one that was being removed, and we got a full display of information, which is mostly information coming off the cluster sender channel, it looks like, when you do that display.
Yes. In that case, you would want to get rid of that manual cluster sender definition since that full repository won't be there anymore. And you still may have to do the refresh, though, to finish cleaning up the information.
When you do the refresh, you do it on the key manager that you were removing? Because that's what the documentation seems.
Okay. Or in your case, it would be your other full repository that still needs some information. Or you can also do the reset to finish taking it out, but you really should not have to do that. The thing about doing the refresh on the one that you've removed is it won't be able to send its information over to that other key manager. Say, clean me up. So I'm just wondering, if I may have to take this offline to think about the exact steps. It just may have to be a combination of a couple of the tasks. If you'd like, you could send me an email and I can do a little bit more research on that. My email is craigbev, that's craigbev at us.ibm.com. Or even better yet, if you just open up a problem record so that information could be documented.
Okay, thanks.
And we'll go next to Vladimir Kononenko with IBC.
Yeah, hello, thanks for the great presentation. So I have basically two questions. So one is is it possible to validate the integrity of the repository, whether it's corrupted or not? And the second question is how the two full repositories are synchronized on a periodical basis, and can you find that?
Okay, on your first question, to validate the integrity of the full repository, there isn't really a utility of any sort. The thing I can think of is with the version 6 Explorer, there is a plugin that can do some validation, and it may, I'm not sure if it does anything specifically with clustering, but it is a plugin that you can download and add on, and that would be available from the MQ website. But other than that, just using your display commands is how you would tell. You know, if there's any sort of a bug that's actually caused some bad information, that would be another matter. You end up needing to send some of your information to the support center. But just so far as normal operations, just using your display commands is what you'd need to do. And then your second question had to do with how two full repositories synchronize. They use internal cluster commands. A lot of what we were talking about would have been application messages, application message data. But the repository also uses some internal messages that go to the system cluster command queue and then across the transmit queue. And it tells the other repository manager information about itself and asks for information. So that's how they exchange information. So it's internal cluster messages.
So can they get out of sync?
Not under normal circumstances, but if some messages got deleted somehow, yes, it could. And you may have to do a refresh to have them re-exchange their information.
Thank you.
Okay.
And we'll go next to Ken Chimarusi with IBM.
Hi, good morning. I actually have three questions, but you can cut me off if it gets too long. The first question is going back to the duplicate QMIDs. We have a very large cluster, and at any given point in time, we might find anywhere from 30 to 50 duplicate QMIDs. And I was curious what some of the problems we might see with that, or what we would expect to see with that, because it doesn't seem to bother anything.
Okay, yes. It really shouldn't, but I have seen instances where it tries to use the old instance of a channel, and it's using the old QMID as part of the information, but then it goes over and looks and finds information for the new QMID, and it knows something doesn't match. So you may have some error messages in your error log, or it may have trouble finding queues. Usually I'm looking at it from the point of view of problems. So if somebody's having a problem and they're coming in, one of the things I'm going to do is say to get rid of those duplicate QMIDs. But if it doesn't seem to be bothering anything and your information seems to be getting exchanged properly, then it's okay.
Look, it could be a case where this is just so large that we're not recognizing some of the issues then. Okay. Can I ask more questions?
Okay.
In version 5, and actually even version 6, but right now in version 5, we do have a need to run refresh cluster because of a star subscription issue that we experience with a workload balancing exit. And I was curious, is there a way to quiesce the refresh cluster in the middle? The reason for this question is because, you know, we'll always reach max active channels because of the size of the cluster. We're just curious if there's a way, like if you can pull message out of the system cluster command queue, or if there's any way to kind of halt things and let it catch up.
Oh, me. I would be...
It's okay to say no.
...concerned about doing that. I wouldn't feel comfortable myself about trying to address that.
So pretty much once you issue the refresh cluster command, you just pretty much just have to let it just go and do its thing.
Right, you know, and just whether you can limit it some to just a cluster, but if it's very large, I guess it sounds like it's still getting too big. And that may go to one of those support packs where it's talking about large clusters and some of the concerns, possibly. I haven't personally read through both of those, but if you go look at those, maybe there would be some guidance there.
Okay. Last question.
Okay.
With max active channels, is there some type of benchmarking or suggestions you might be able to provide in identifying the best setting for max active channels?
Okay. Again, I would refer to those support packs. And also, there's another one. Now, is this, well, I'm a little bit more ZOS focused. And if it were ZOS, I would say there's a support pack called MP, as in Mary Peter 16, that provides some guidance. Other than that, your system administration guide may have some guidance, or there may be some other support packs out there for the various platforms that talk about benchmarks.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
And there are no other questions at this time. I'd like to turn the conference back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
At this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Beverly and Anghu, for presenting today.
Thank you.